Welcome to the MLB Trade Rumors Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the MLB Trade Rumors Podcast. My name is Dara McDonald and this episode is brought to you by StatHead. We've all had that moment when we look at a player's stats and it raises more questions. When did someone last hit for a cycle? How many pitchers had an ERA that low over any 20-game span? StatHead has the answers. StatHead is your all-access pass to go inside the Baseball Reference database and answer virtually any questions about baseball stats and history. Use code MLBTR for 20% off annual baseball or annual all-sports subscriptions. With me this week to talk about all the baseball stuff is my colleague Steve Adams. What's up, Steve?
Hey, Dara. Doing all right. I've got kind of a gnarly cold going here right now, so we'll try not to cough into the microphone too much and apologize for any gravelly or weird tones that come from my general face region. We'll see how we do.
Very courteous of you to...
I try.
Yeah. Okay, so Steve, I bet you 8-1 we talk about Ohtani on this episode.
What you think? Maybe.
So I assume everybody knows by now because it's a massive story. But just in case you don't, there is a big gambling scandal in baseball that the biggest star in the sport is adjacent to. And we don't really know for sure at this point exactly how connected he is. So basically, the story that Ohtani is telling is that his translator is responsible for everything. He was making illegal bets. Sports betting is illegal in California. So he's placing bets with a bookie, ran up like $4.5 million of debt, somehow wired that much money to the bookie using Ohtani's bank account, and then weaved an elaborate web of lies to try to cover his tracks. Is that the basics, Steve? Did I miss anything important there of like the basic, like the Ohtani side of the story?
Aside from the completely different original story that he told, I think that kind of generally covers it. And I think that's kind of the issue that has raised a lot of eyebrows is that the initial report on the matter, or I guess Ohtani's initial statements on the matter, he did an interview, I believe, with ESPN, correct?
Ohtani.
Mizuhara, his interpreter, did an interview with, let's get that right, my mistake, sorry, but did an interview with ESPN.
Yeah.
Kind of saying, you know, laying out a very different version of events where, you know, Ohtani kind of, sat down with him and said, okay, like, you know, you're going to be done with this. We're going to pay this debt off together. No more gambling from here on out, but I'll make it right. And I'll right the wrongs that you've set basically. And it took all of, 24 hours for that story to go up in flames and instead just be like, nope. It was theft, and everything. And Ohtani knew nothing of it. And I think just the about face has a lot of people understandably kind of questioning, you know, what's really at play here. Like you said, you know, we don't know much right now. I think a lot of people are making broad reaching assumptions, which is natural with especially with a story, a scandal, I guess, of this magnitude and with a star of Ohtani's caliber, particularly, you know. He's been the focus of the baseball offseason and signing the record contract with the record slated deferrals that, you know, some people viewed as a controversy in and of itself. And so there was already kind of I think Ohtani had built up some animosity from fans of non-Dodger teams just because there was some perception that, they exploited a loophole with the deferrals in the contract and everything. And that kind of upset some people. And I think a lot of people now are ready to just jump and say, all right, well, clearly he's guilty of this. Like, he's a bad guy. We don't know that. We don't know a lot of the details. And I think the best thing that there is to do is kind of just let it play out and see the details as they unfold. You know, there's obviously an investigation ongoing into this, and I'm sure we'll learn more as that plays out and as the investigative process with MLB transpires. But It doesn't look good. I think the optics of it are terrible. I would say it's a colossal like PR misstep just to, you know, have two just rampantly different, wildly different versions of the story come out in such rapid succession. They're diametrically opposed, basically. And so it inherently says like, hey, one of these is BS, basically. And like that inevitably, of course, is going to lead some people to draw some conclusions of their own, fair or unfair. And it's just a mess that I'm sure baseball and the Dodgers and Ohtani, it's not how they wanted to, you know, start their season after signing, you know, making this big historic free agent splash and getting, you know, the probably the most talented baseball player on the planet. And it's already embroiled in kind of this controversy that, in my view, like probably will follow him for a very long time, if not the rest of his career. Like what are your thoughts on kind of the reach that this story has?
There are definitely some people who I was working, I was doing the feed, like working the website the other day when Ohtani was giving his statements. And what I gleaned from Twitter/X is that there are some people who are already 100% convinced that Ohtani is like this degenerate Pete Rose style gambler. Yep. And this is all some elaborate conspiracy to cover it up and say, sweep it under the rug, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So definitely there are some people who will never, no matter what evidence comes out, will never change their mind about that, I'm sure. But I think, I mean, right now we have more questions than answers, so it's really tough to draw conclusions. Ohtani's explanation for the differing stories is that the stories were coming from Mizuhara, the interpreter. And now that, there are further questions now, because the way Ohtani tells it, he was just completely in the dark because he was 100% reliant on Mizuhara to handle all of his interactions with everybody. And so maybe I don't really know how this kind of stuff works, but is it like, you know, all of his lawyers and like public relations people, like none of them speak Japanese in Ohtani's camp, I guess, is the claim.
I can't imagine that's the case. But again, like that's one of those, like you said, there's more questions than answers. So we don't know the extent to that, but that would just be astonishing. That would be crazy to me, but I suppose that's kind of the angle that they're pushing.
Or at least the people who do speak Japanese don't also speak English, and Mizuhara is the only one who speaks both. I don't know. Whatever it is, Ohtani's claiming that he knew nothing until this week about any of this, didn't know anything about debts, anything about gambling, etc. Whether that's plausible will come out in the investigation, I hope. And the other big question that a lot of other people have pointed out is about the money transfers, the wire transfers.
Yeah.
How did Mizuhara get access to Ohtani's bank accounts? You know, did he have like direct access, or was it like he went to Ohtani's accountants and was like, Ohtani told me to send money to this guy, and the accountants just did it because they're used to getting instructions from Mizuhara and assuming that they come from Ohtani? And then, you know, like how did Ohtani not notice the money was missing, or like his accountants or whoever, you know, there's lots of
like an alert from his bank. Like, hey, this is your ninth $500,000 transfer in the past X number of.
If Ohtani's English isn't great, then presumably Mizuhara was the one reading those alerts from the bank. That's the whole story, is that like as all of this was going on, Ohtani didn't know anything, because anytime any like flag was raised, Mizuhara was the one who was responsible for conveying the information to him. And so he was never getting the full story. So I don't know. It's quite a tale.
There's some level of plausibility to that, in the sense, like maybe not to the quite this extreme, but I can buy to an extent, like, hey, I'm focused on baseball. I've got, you know, between my MLB contracts and all my endorsements and all this stuff, I mean, I basically have more money than God. Like, I don't want to deal with managing this. I've got people to deal with that for me. My focus is on the field, like that sort of thing. So like there is some level of like plausibility to a scenario, I guess, where Ohtani was just like, I want, you know, this isn't what I want to handle. I have enough money that I can, like, you know, pay people to handle this for me. Mm-hmm. But it's, like you said, there's just a lot of questions about it. I'm not going to make any assumptions. It's to me, I kind of referenced earlier, there were people who just had a bad taste in their mouth from how his free agency played out, the contract, the deferrals and everything. I think there were a large number of people who would have just jumped on whatever scandal popped up. It was just going to be, he's guilty. We're sick of him. We hate him. We don't like him. MLB's mm-hmm. golden boy is a sham. Ban him, get rid of him. He's trash. He's bad for the game. But I think the way that everything has played out has given people who would take a more level-headed, rational approach to this, has unfortunately given them some reason to like ask questions and raise doubt. And that's, for lack of a better way to put it, like that just kind of sucks. Like he's, you know, the most entertaining player I think I've, you know, watched in my, you know, nearly four decades of baseball fandom. And, it's not something that you want to see surrounding any player, let alone, you know, somebody of his status who, you know, has such a broad reach and could bring in so many eyes and so many new fans to the game. So yeah, more questions than answers. We'll see how it plays out. But it's just an unfortunate note to start the 2024 season on. And I'm sure the Dodgers and baseball and Ohtani and fans everywhere are kind of feeling that.
Yeah. Yeah, we would love to just be talking ball like we do on this podcast, but for this second week in a row, we're focused on these off-field issues.
Yeah.
We'll see. I like you said, I'm also keeping an open mind until the investigation plays out and we'll see where it goes. Right now, I have to be honest, maybe this is naive, but I'm leaning Ohtani innocence just because he came out so hard on the theft story in his comments to the media the other day. Because yeah. I think if there was any truth to the original story that he did the wire transfers to help out his buddy and didn't really realize that that was a federal crime or whatever, if that was true, I think he would have given a more like wishy-washy statement where he was just like, oh, I can't talk about it. The investigation is going on. I'll have a further, a more detailed statement at another time, yada, yada, yada. But he came out firm, hard, leaned into the theft story and was like, I didn't know anything. I didn't know about the debt. I didn't know about the gambling. I didn't know about the wire transfers. I knew nothing. He was lying about everything. And so he's really leaning into it. So I think he would not have done that because it's just going to backfire if it turns out that it's not true. And he's it's going to be worse.
I think the other thing too that kind of like leads me to, at least for now, like beyond just, you know, hey, nothing's been proven, so you assume innocence, but like also just like it would just be like so brazenly like, I guess, stupid, like for lack of a better term, to like have your name on these like wire transfers for millions of dollars to a bookie. Mm-hmm. And just like think like, oh, nothing's going to happen. Nothing's going to touch me. Like, cause it doesn't seem like it was well hidden. So like, it's just one of those things like this is going to come out. And like, if you were really making these illegal bets and you're this high profile star, and would you be so careless? And like, that is also hard to believe. It would almost like there would be more credence to, you know, Ohtani being this, you know, like secret degenerate gambler if it took all this like crazy investigative reporting and there were all kinds of fake names and aliases and you know, like back channel cryptocurrency payments and all this stuff. And it's like, no, it's a direct wire transfer with his name on it. And it's like that.
Right.
It would just be, I just have such a hard time believing like that level of like brazen, just carelessness would, you know, be at play if he really were culpable in this situation. So I don't know. We'll see where it goes, but like you said earlier, second week in a row, you know, we're a couple days from opening day as we record this. And in less than 48 hours, we're recording on Tuesday night. In less than 48 hours, there are going to be actual Major League Baseball games being played for all 30 teams, you know, here in North America. And we're not talking about any of that. And it's like, that's not what anybody wants this time of year. It's an unfortunate situation.
Yeah. We'll see how it goes. Lots of questions with any explanation that anyone has provided has not been 100% satisfactory because there are questions with all of them. So we'll see how it goes. So quickly, I do want to get to talking ball because that's what we like to do on this show. But I think one more non-ball or ball adjacent subject that we should at least address because we talked about it for like 20 minutes last week. Yep. So we should at least quickly follow up on this MLBPA stuff because it seems, per the latest reporting, that the coup, the mutiny, whatever you want to call it, has sort of fizzled out. Did you have any hot takes about the latest developments?
No, I mean, it's just, this is another one of those things where, like, similar to the Ohtani situation, we're going to get different stories from all sides of this. We're never going to know exactly how things unfolded. I think it's a little telling that, you know, we've had some more player Q&As from some of the guys in the executive subcommittee within the union. Jack Flaherty was talking to The Athletic this week and kind of backpedaling and saying, you know, expressing tremendous remorse that he even, you know, allowed the situation to get where it was and voicing strong, you know, backing for Tony Clark. And it seems like the union is doing its best to just kind of move away from, you know, this conversation or this notion that there's any, you know, scenario where Harry Marino, who's the lawyer who ran Advocates for Minor Leaguers and negotiated the minor league collective bargaining agreement alongside Bruce Meyer, who is the union's deputy director. Seems like the union is now kind of trying to just push away and say, like, there's no scenario where he's going to rise to power. Like we kind of like the media kind of was portraying in this like supposed coup attempt. The whole palace intrigue of this story has, it's not the way that I want to, you know, dedicate my time and my thoughts to so close to the season. So it's almost like a little perturbing where it's just like, again, like with the Ohtani thing, it's like, this is what we're talking about right now. Like baseball's right around the corner. There's all these like crazy roster decisions and camp battles playing out. And we're talking about, you know, who's going to negotiate the CBA, you know, 3 years from now, 2 years from now, whenever it is. So no, I don't have like hot, spicy takes on the latest developments. I'm glad it seems like there's maybe a push for some continuity. I don't know. Well, you've focused on this more than I have in the past few days. Like, what are your thoughts? Where do you lean here?
Yeah, well, we can quickly move on, but I will say we talked about this for like 20 minutes last week, and I was concerned, but like I thought it was sort of. I don't know, like a panicky sort of move from the union because, you know, it seemed to me like they did pretty well on the most recent CBA negotiations that came out of the lockout. And, you know, for them to sort of be talking about making all these like hasty changes just because this offseason has been less than ideal was concerning to me. It seemed like a bad move. But the fact that things have sort of calmed down and cooler heads have prevailed seems to be good. So hopefully it's all good. And anyway, okay. So enough of that. Let's talk ball. Let's talk ball.
Baseball.
Yeah. So Steve and I, we are recording this on the evening of Tuesday, March 26th, which means that by the time you're listening to this, maybe the season has started. Maybe it's like within 24 hours of starting. Baseball, I mean, we obviously had the Seoul series already, but all the teams are going to be playing very, very soon. The 2024 baseball season is upon us. So let's talk ball. Because of the slow off season, there are still things happening.
Major things.
JD Martinez finally signed here towards the end of spring training with the Mets. Were you surprised by the way this played out? The Mets also optioned Mark Vientos, who for a long time it seemed like they were committed to having him be their DH, but now it seems like he'll be in the minors, JDM in the majors. So were you surprised by him landing with the Mets, how it played out, et cetera? Thoughts, Steve?
I was surprised. I had said several times, like in the chats that I run on the site and stuff, like I just didn't think the Mets were going to, if he got to the point where he was going to sign for $6 million or something, which would have been, you know, insane, a whole different level of insanity that we'd be talking about right now for a hitter of Martinez's caliber. Even the $12 million price point, excuse me, is a pretty good bargain for a hitter of his caliber.
And it's $12 million deferred, right? Like we
it
should
is,
say
it is deferred, but that doesn't change the fact that it's a $12 million AAV annual value, and thus comes with a 110% luxury tax hit on that. So there's $13.2 million of taxes. Did I just did that in my head? Did I do that right? I think I did. There's $13.2 million of taxes coming with the signing on top of the money that they're actually paying him, which is deferred. Yes, but. It really seemed like The Mets were number one committed to kind of seeing, okay, we want to see what we have in Brett Beatty and Mark Vientos. And, you know, between those two guys, like we can get them a lot of bats between designated hitter and third base. And it also seemed like they just didn't have, you know, necessarily the appetite for making that one more big splash. They've had a lot of injuries, excuse me, on the, particularly the Kodai Senga.
I hate to interrupt you here, Steve, not just because you're cold, but I think for the first time since I've been doing this podcast, we have breaking news on the podcast.
Okay.
Jordan Montgomery to the Diamondbacks.
Wow. Speaking of things that I was just saying, oh man, just kind of downplaying in my chat today. Huh? All right.
Jeff Passan just tweeted this a couple minutes ago. An agreement on a deal pending a physical, but it doesn't have any terms.
The terms are coming out quickly, though. You got Heyman and Rosenthal saying $25 million this season with the player option, besting player option for the second year. So, I mean, great deal for the Diamondbacks. Like, wow, yeah.
$25 million. Wow.
I know. It's not even the necessarily the 3 year kind of, you know, opt out laden deal that we were 2 year opt out laden deal that we've seen, you know, the other Boris guys signed. So,
But it's a vesting option. I guess we'll find the details.
The vesting player option. So it probably, I assume he's going to have to, you know, hit 130, 140 innings, whatever. And then he picks up the player option would vest. So
it's really interesting for the Diamondbacks. This is just hot takes,
off the bat, just off as we were bat. Saying, we still got things happening 2 days before opening day. Here we go.
Wild. Yeah. This is part of the MLB conspiracy to distract from Ohtani. No. but for the Diamondbacks, I think off the top of my head, I think they were already set for a record payroll or at least
by a fair bit, too, which is why I kind of was like a little skeptical earlier today. There's been some talk about the Diamondbacks and Montgomery a little bit. I know Jim Bowden with The Athletic kind of said, like, hey, don't sleep on them. But we're going to be clicking around here, but they're already set for $143 million payroll per the fine folks at Roster Resource, Jason Martinez, Fangraphs over there. They do an awesome job. They're at $143 million. Their previous franchise record was $131 back in 2018. So, I mean, they were already, you know, 12-ish million dollars above that, and now they're going to bump that another 25. I mean, you're talking, they're going to be, we'll see with deferrals and everything, but they're going to be almost $40 million over their previous high watermark. Like, that's not something you see teams do that often.
And it's very interesting because, again, off the top of my head, they did just go to the World Series last year, you know, somewhat unexpectedly. So they probably got a lot of playoff revenues that they weren't necessarily counting on having. Mm-hmm. But also at the same time, they were one of the teams that like their TV deal died, I believe. So all of their TV revenue is gone. So it is interesting that they are going so aggressive with the TV money gone. But hey, good for them. They're coming off the World Series. And it came out this week that Eduardo Rodriguez has a lat strain.
Yep.
So a big hole opened up in the rotation.
And now you look at if you're later in the season and you're getting, you know, if you get to a situation where you have Montgomery and Erod healthy, then you're suddenly looking at a rotation with Zach Allen, Jordan Montgomery, Eduardo Rodriguez, Merrill Kelly, and probably Brandon Pfaadt in the five spot. Like, that's a really strong group of starting pitching. It might be, you know, best laid plans, you know, never seem to come to fruition in baseball, as evidenced by the fact that with pitching staffs anyway, as evidenced by the fact that that Rodriguez is already, you know, banged up and out for a yet to be determined period of time with the lat strain. So maybe we never get to a point where all five of those guys are healthy, but like it's a really talented group of five if they can get them all healthy at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So cool. This is exciting. The first time. It's crazy. The season starts in like 36 hours.
Yeah.
We're getting breaking news while recording the podcast.
Like, yeah. Our number like six free agent from the top 50 back in November is signing right now. And yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah. All right. So, okay. I guess Monty's off the board. Maybe we'll talk about that more if more details come out. But there's some off the dome reaction for you. including a Steve from sneeze from Steve Adams.
I think it was a cough, not a sneeze. Thank
you
very much.
Oh, it was a cough. Oh, okay. Sounded like a sneeze to me, but.
Oh, geez. All right.
Okay. So since we started talking about it, let's go back to finish JD Martinez. So the Mets, like you said, paying lots of taxes to get 1 year of this DH. And then, you know, it's interesting because the Mets were supposed to be doing a sort of like, I don't know what word you would use. It's not a rebuild, but a sort of, I think people have used the word bridge year.
Bridge, transition, a step back. There's all, whatever. There's a million different things you want to call it, but it's basically just like, we're not going to go all out to try to compete this year. We want to see what some of the young guys like Vientos and Mark Vientos and Brett Beatty, you know, if they can step up and be key pieces for us, or if we need to, you know, kind of look elsewhere next off season. So,
and so it's interesting that now I don't know if their opinion of Vientos changed or if they just figure that he'll be up at some point because somebody will get injured. And so even with Martinez on the roster, he will still get lots of at bats, but it is interesting that they have sort of, it does signal a pivot away from that, at least to some degree, perhaps.
Yeah. And I think some of that probably too comes to, you know, Martinez was definitely looking for a 2 year deal for a lot of the offseason. You know, I put him at 2 years and 38 million, 40 million on the top hit. I can't remember. So, I mean, that's another one that we were, you know, I think we expected teams to kind of come out hard after spending so much last offseason, and particularly on veteran hitters with such a poor market for. For good hitters, there just weren't many impact bats on the market this year, and a lot of it didn't really play out that way. I think in part because of the TV uncertainty throughout the league. But I do wonder if just, you know, once he kind of said, okay, like the 2 years isn't going to be there, let's start looking at 1 year deals. You know, there was the report that I think the Giants offered him was at 14 for 1 year. And so now he's going to take, you know, less than that and with some deferrals with the Mets, but maybe ends up in a better spot, you know, maybe whether personal preference for the location or likes the ballpark better or whatever it might be. I think it probably just got to a point where the Mets said, like, OK, you know, we can't pass this up. If he was looking for, you know, 2 years and $36 million or whatever, you know, by the time you factor in the taxes and everything, you're going to end up paying almost $80 million to have him for 2 years at that rate. Whereas here it's deferred 1 year, $13 million in taxes. So, you know, in the long run, you're going to end up paying a year and, you know, $20 to $25 million. That's not dissimilar from what the, you know, the Dodgers wound up paying Teoscar Hernandez on that 1 year deal. So it falls more in line with kind of like what teams are willing to pay for a player of this skill set and this caliber. So it's a nice get for them. It stings for Vientos, obviously, but like you said, to your point, injuries are inevitable. They're going to have opportunities for Vientos to come up, and you know, whether it's at third base, whether it's at first base, designated hitter, like they'll find, you know, ways to get him in the mix this year, provided that he, you know, hits in AAA, which he's done pretty consistently. So it strengthens the Mets' chances for this year, which is never, you know, I don't think they, like you said, they never went into a rebuild. They were never going to, you know, completely punt this year. So good on them for kind of continuing to spend here and there where they see fit. It makes the NL East that much more entertaining, just like, you know, Montgomery going to the D-backs makes the NL West, you know, a division, you know, more fun to watch and more fun to track. It's fun when, you know, these already strong divisions, you know, kind of keep beefing up late in the offseason.
Yeah. As much as the offseason has been really slow and frustrating for players, I think it's interesting in that there are very few teams that you could point to and say they are definitely not a contending club on opening day. It's maybe like, I don't know, four or five, depending on your opinion, but it's not a huge number, which I guess is because of the expanded playoffs playing a huge role in that. Okay, so let's talk. One other thing I thought about on Montgomery, which, I mean, I don't know, maybe this isn't interesting enough to talk about for an extended period of time, but they have an agreement in place. Opening day is on Thursday. I wonder if the deal will not become official until after opening day, and then he won't be eligible for a qualifying offer at the end of the season. That's probable?
I mean, why wouldn't you at this point? It's so close. Like, as long as he's not on that official roster.
From his perspective, you mean, why wouldn't he? Right.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Like, if he's already conceding here saying, okay, like, I'm going to take the 1 year deal. It's it, you know, we're not even going to make you guarantee me 2 or 3 years and give me the, you know, the guarantee me 1 year. If I get pitch enough innings or whatever, like, we'll get the player option tacked on there. That's already like a pretty big concession for a guy who was looking for, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, whatever it was, like earlier in the offseason. I mean, make the deal official on Friday and then he can't receive a qualifying offer at the end of the year. Like, yeah, that stings for the Diamondbacks. Obviously, you want to be able to make that qualifying offer. You want to be able to get that draft pick if he leaves and goes out the door. But I think he's already dropped his price to the point where it's, you know, he's making a pretty big concession. I think they can, you know, make that concession too. I'm surprised still that, you know, with this deal that, you know, that the Red Sox didn't, there's so much talk about Boston and their interest in Montgomery this offseason, and he wanted the, you know, long-term deal there. His wife's doing her medical residency in Boston. They are not close.
She's not there anymore. She was there in the winter. I saw Tim talked about this in his mailbag. She got a job in like one of the Virginias or one of the Carolinas or something. So she's not in Massachusetts anymore. She was doing a residency there.
Was always like a tangential part of it anyway, but like it just seems like with Giolito, you know, undergoing elbow surgery and stuff, like this just seemed like an easy fit, especially at this price point. But maybe the Red Sox just kind of figured, we've already lost the first guy that we signed, like our rotation's kind of in shambles, like this year just maybe isn't going to be our year, so why go throw another $25 million at a roster that, you know, is rife with holes. But it's surprising to me. I think it you know, speaks volumes. This is kind of like the type of move you would have expected, you know, the Red Sox to make in yesteryear, in the days of yore, way back in the day, like, you know, 2018. Instead, you know, now it's the Diamondbacks kind of saying,
or the,
like,
Orioles.
Nope, yeah.
Why aren't the Orioles getting in?
I know. There's so many. Yeah. The Orioles have nothing on the payroll. That they would be. It's crazy to me. But good on the Diamondbacks. For getting it done. And it's gonna be a nice move for them, I think. You know, and it strengthens their chances of getting back to, you know, finish what they started last year. So
yeah. The other thing too about like the qualifying offer thing, I actually, now that I'm thinking about it, it might not be that huge a deal, because this vesting option, according to Mark Feinsand of MLB.com, the vesting option vests if he makes 10 starts in 2024. Unless he's hurt, this is basically a 2-year deal. And so the qualifying offer won't come into play until the end of 2025. So this sort of, you know, kicking the deal past opening day in 2024, so he's not eligible for the qualifying offer, isn't really a huge factor.
It's a vesting player option though, right? So if it's a player option that vests, then he could turn down that player option and go back out to free agency.
Is it a player option? I thought it was a vesting option as in like becomes guaranteed, but
maybe I'm just making up that it was a player. I swore I saw somebody out here putting out flair. This is like, we're sitting here like trying to record this and also just like basically following along with this on Twitter rather than like actually
it's
like
fun.
Doing our due diligence. Yeah. So,
oh yeah, vesting player. Rosenthal said vesting player option. So okay, yes, so he will be able to opt out if he makes 10 starts.
Yeah. Okay. This is like amateur hour over here.
I think it's great. Talking off the cuff
and like we're just like, I'll let them figure it out.
Who knows when this is going to happen again? This is great. This is a major free agent deal coming in. We're trying to figure it out in real time. Okay. So yeah. So then that means that it's in Montgomery's interest to not sign the deal until after opening day, because then if he makes 10 starts this year, he can opt out of he can decline the player option and then go back into free agency once again without a qualifying offer, as he did this winter.
Yep.
All right. Okay. Well, let's quickly then talk about the Rangers, because
we got some Rangers stuff. Yeah.
It seemed for at least portions of the winter, there were certain people who were convinced that Montgomery and the Rangers would circle back to each other. But that ended up not happening. And there was kind of a nail in that coffin recently when the Rangers signed Michael Lorenzen instead, who was another free agent who had to linger on the open market past the middle of March. And The Rangers signed him last week for $4.5 million, which seemed to be a really big, okay, Montgomery's not coming back kind of thing.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to point out the humor in your podcast outline that you sent me. It, you know, says Rangers sign Lorenzen, Montgomery back to Texas, now officially off the table, question mark. As we're talking, like right before we get to that point, it's like, I think we can definitely say it's off the table now.
Well, I think we also talked about that every time it came up this winter, Evan Grant of the Dallas Morning News kept throwing cold water on the fit over and over and over again. He just kept being
pounding
like,
that drum. This anytime, will not happen.
Yeah. Every week he wrote a column being like, yeah, no, they're not going to sign Montgomery. And he was right.
Yeah. No, you know, Lorenzen's another one, just different magnitude and different scope, obviously, but like he ends up on a 1 year deal for $4.5 million, which is, you know, way lighter than I think anybody would have reasonably expected heading into the offseason, just as, you know, Montgomery at a year and 25 is way lighter than anyone would have expected. These sort of things happen as you linger in free agency for one reason or another. We don't know the specifics of it. But, you know, oftentimes, I guess with Montgomery, we do to some extent. If he was, you know, out really seeking a 7-year contract, that might have been too steep for some teams. And at the end of the day, then, you know, by the time you drop your price to what clubs consider more reasonable, their money's been spent, and what was reasonable in November no longer looks reasonable in January, February. Lorenzen's a pretty extreme example of that. You know, he's signed 1-year deals each of the last two off seasons, and now for a third straight off season. And you look like when he was leaving the Reds, he was a, you know, setup man who was, you know, wanted to take, probably could have gotten multi-year offers as a reliever and wanted to take that 1-year deal to prove that he could start. And, you know, when he was transitioning from the bullpen to a rotation, he got, I think, $6.75 million from the Angels. So, you know, considerably more, like 1.5 times what he's getting here from Texas, at a time when he had, you know, thrown, I don't know, 60, 70 innings the year prior. He threw 150-something innings last year. And then his first year with the Angels, I think he was limited to around 100 innings, maybe just shy because of some injuries, and went out and signed another 1-year deal for 8.5 with the Tigers. So for him to, you know, take less than he made either of the past two seasons, now that he's basically finally gone out and worked more or less a starter's workload over the course of a full season, threw a no-hitter in there. It's pretty surprising to me. Obviously, it's tied directly to the portion of the offseason in which he signed, but it's a nice get for the Rangers. They've had a lot of injuries on that pitching staff. I think some of the moves that they made, if their funds were really this limited, like, I don't know if you need to spend $11.5 million on David Robertson or spend $22 million on Tyler Mahle when he's not going to pitch in the first half. And you already kind of knew that you had some injury concerns with DeGrom and Scherzer, but this is a nice way to kind of mitigate some of that late in the off season, and add some depth and really some higher quality, higher upside depth than a lot of the standard, you know, kind of pitchers who are going to sign in and around this price point earlier in the off season. So it's nice for them. I don't know that it like seismically shifts their playoff odds or anything, but it certainly raises their floor, raises their margin for error, and gives them more depth in the event that, you know, further injuries happen, or that just, you know, some of the guys, the Mahle and Scherzer and DeGrom, don't recover as quickly as possible, or as expected. And if they do, then in the season's second half, you can, you know, Lorenzen is no stranger to pitching in the bullpen. So he's already got that, you know, experience in the late innings, got that mindset down. It's a nice move to be able to kind of shift him to that late inning role that he knows very well. If you get everyone back up to full strength later on.
All right. Well, while we are on the Rangers, we also got a couple of big pieces of news about top prospects, one of which is a Ranger. So Wyatt Langford is going to make the opening day roster for the Rangers, but Jackson Holliday is not going to make the roster of the Orioles. Were you surprised? Do you have feelings about either of these, Steve?
Surprised just in the sense that I think it's been, you know, I think a few months now since you know, Mike Elias, the Orioles general manager, and Brandon Hyde, their manager, kind of started talking up the possibility of Holliday, you know, breaking camp with the team he hasn't really done anything this spring to kind of suggest, hey, he's not ready. He tore up the minors last year. He had a big spring training, and it's just, it's a little befuddling, I guess, that the, you know, the, not only did they send him to minor league camp, reassign him at the end of last week, but then a few days later, you know, now they just earlier today, Tuesday, they signed Tony Kemp to a big league contract. You know, it feels like every year they just want to have that kind of, you know, token grizzled veteran infielder on the roster. You know, that they've had Jose Iglesias and Rougned Odor and Adam Frazier.
Well, I was going to say, so Mike Elias, you know, because it really seemed like Holiday was going to make the roster for most of spring training, because he was just playing great. And he's, you know, the best prospect in baseball, even though he's young, you know, he yep. just seems really good. So the explanation that was given is that he needs to get more work at second base because he came up as a shortstop, and he needs to get more reps against left-handed pitching. Does that mm-hmm. seem, does that pass the smell test for you?
It does. Like, I think they're all justifiable. Like, it, look, I talked about this in my chat on the site today. Like, it's logical and rational to say, hey, this kid's 20. He's barely played above, you know, A ball, let alone double A. I think he, you know, had a handful of games in triple A last year late in the season. But like, sure, it's fair to say he does not have much experience in the upper minors. I don't know about like the getting acclimated to second base as much, because like he's already a capable defensive shortstop. I don't feel like asking him to slide to the other side of the bag is like some seismic shift. But facing left-handed pitching more, certainly, yeah, there's some merit to that and everything. It just, yeah, they've kind of, I think they kind of set an expectation like, hey, this is possible. And then you see him go to camp and like, he really, you know, kind of just rips it up in spring training. I think a lot of people were just expecting it. Those who are kind of decrying, oh, it's service time manipulation, I don't really buy that as much, just because unless they want to hold him in the minors until, you know, July or something like that, like, or August, like, if you bring him up even in early May, like, that's plenty of time for somebody with, you know, his talent and everything to put himself in position to either finish first or second in the rookie of the year voting. And if he does that, then he's going to get the full year of service time anyway. And there's also, you know, long-term now benefit for the Orioles. If he had, you know, like the prospect promotion incentives, like, have pushed teams to, you know, be more aggressive, as the Rangers are with Wyatt Langford, when I'm sure we'll touch on him in a minute. But, you know, if he comes up and ends up winning that rookie of the year, then, you know, the Orioles are going to be rewarded in the draft next year. So I don't necessarily buy the service time manipulations. I just think they kind of erred in setting some expectations that, hey, you know, he's got a good chance to break camp, and then he comes to camp and like, you really can't find, at least just, you know, watching him play, you know, briefly here and there and looking at his stat line and everything, he looks ready. And to then say, it creates this question of like, well, what more could he have done? And why were you like even beginning to set this expectation that he could break camp with the team, if after the spring that he just had, you're going to send him down anyway? I think that's the point of frustration for Orioles fans, I imagine.
Yeah, personally, I think it's service time manipulation. It's just hard for me to see how, like,
long are they going to keep him? How long are they going to keep him down for, though?
Long enough to let Wyatt Langford build up a nice base of like 15 home runs and be the clear leader in the rookie of the year. And they'll need a second person to be in there.
Yeah. See, it's just so hard to say, unless you're planning to keep him down till middle of the summer. Like, it's just so hard to say we're going to keep him down for a month. And plus, like, this is your 1 year with Corbin Burnes. Like, why are you not attacking? Like, I don't know. I don't know that the service time thing, to me, if it is that, like, that's just real short-sighted. It's just really short-sighted. But then again, I think it's short-sighted that they didn't, you know, go sign Jordan Montgomery to the exact deal that the Diamondbacks just did, especially with Kyle Bradish being, you know, banged up and trying to rehab a UCL injury without undergoing surgery. They should be getting another arm in that rotation, and they're not. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. If they're playing service time games in the 1 year of Corbin Burnes that they have, then they are making like a substantial mistake. So in my view,
they just have a million prospects, and they're going into the season with Ramon Urias as like an everyday, infielder. And, and I'm just like, that's clearly not, I mean, nothing against him. He's a fine, he's a gold glove winner and all that kind of stuff, but it's just, he's a not
really nice utility player to have. Yeah.
Utility player. Yeah.
Yes.
But like, he's not, he, you know, they could put together a better opening day lineup with Holiday or Kobe Mayo or somebody anyway.
Yeah. Tony Kemp. I mean, again, not, I don't want to disparage Tony Kemp. Like Tony Kemp is a nice
fine,
player. Like,
fine player. Seems like a nice guy.
Yes, I shouldn't poke fun there. Like, it's like good for him that he landed on a big league roster. It's just surprising to me that it's this big league roster.
Okay, we have to get to your questions now. We have so much that Jordan Montgomery breaking news really threw me off my plan. We got a big extension for the Rockies that we're not even going to have time to talk about.
We can talk about it quick. I think there's, you know, like we can okay, go so through it quick.
$63.5 million over 7 years for Ezekiel Tovar. Good for him. Good for the Rockies, maybe. What do you think, Steve?
So, like, I don't know. Like, Tovar can play the absolute hell out of shortstop. I don't think anybody's going to question him on that. And so from that standpoint, like, I think it's probably unlikely that it's just gonna like bomb out completely, because like no matter what happens, like you probably feel like you have a gold glove caliber shortstop in there every day, and that's gonna be worth some money. It's just whether it's worth, you know, 63.5 million dollars for a guy who has just not hit yet in the majors. And I know that the Rockies are bullish on him and expect him to hit more. He did hit 15 home runs last year and stole 11 or 12 bases. So like there's some counting stats there, but the on base percentage is not good. I think he's probably going to be like lower batting average, like lower on base guy, which isn't necessarily bad in and of itself, but you wonder like, would he get to these heights in arbitration if they just went year to year with him? Maybe, maybe not. It's not like the end of the world if he ends up like being a Nick Ahmed type or an Elvis Andrews type. And like, you know, he's on this $63 million extension. It just feels like the Rockies like get really like every time one of their homegrown guys gets like a little bit of success in the big leagues, they get like really excited. And it's like, we've got to extend him now. And it's like, you look at the deals that they've cut with Kyle Freeland and Antonio Sensatella and Ryan McMahon, and they extended Elias Diaz and Tyler Kinley, and like they keep doing these, you know, like mid-range extensions for guys who had a little bit of success, but they don't necessarily like end up being the type of bargains that you want to see in these pre-arb extensions, know, and so this could end up being another one of those. But like, again, Tovar can play defense at such a high level that I think he can easily be worth $60 million or whatever over the next 7 years. It's just a matter of, you know, arbitration was never going to pay him hugely for being an amazing defender. So are they committing $63.5 million to a guy who might have cost half that in arbitration? We'll see. If he ends up hitting like they think he can, then it's going to be a great deal for them. There is that, like, because the glove is so good, if he gets to the point where he's even an average hitter, like, it's going to be a steal. It's just it's a big bet on his offense right now. Do you have differing thoughts? Where do you land?
No, I think you summed it up. It's not going to be a disaster, presumably, like you said, because of his defense that gives it a solid floor. But I'm just so skeptical of the Rockies because, as you eloquently laid out, they've done this so many times where they put a big bet down on one of their guys and it has not worked out very often. But we'll see. Like you said, if the bat comes around, it'll be a steal, but it's a big if.
And it's not something where I think like there some of the extensions they've signed in the past, like they've done it and I've kind of like, I'm like, really? Okay. And like that, I was a little surprised that Tovar got the extension, but like when I sat down and thought about it, it's like, okay, well, yeah, the glove is so good. Like it's almost impossible for it to just like completely blow up in their face unless, like, I don't know, he forgets how to play defense or suffers like, you know, 12 injuries in the next few years. So,
right. Which is a risk with any deal. So
exactly.
Okay. So let's get to your questions. We have rambled a lot. Breaking news. It's been quite a show.
Sure.
But we got a question here from Mike, who seems to be an Astros fan, perhaps, because he is asking specifically about the Astros and why they are not moving their injured guys to the 60-day injured list. Luis Garcia, Lance McCullers Jr., and Kendall Graveman are out at the very least until the middle of June. So why are they not being moved to the 60-day injured list?
Because teams make that move when it's a corresponding move for another 40-man addition. So the short answer is it doesn't really matter because they're going to put them they're going to put all three of those pitchers on the 15-day injured list on opening day, and they're going to backdate it the maximum 3 days possible. That you can't backdate it any more than 3 days, and the 60-day term begins when they're put on the injured list. So is retroactive to when they're put on the injured list in the first place. So just because, even if they don't place one of those guys on the 60-day IL until the end of April, say, it's not the 60-day starts from April 29th. The 60 days will still be retroactive to opening day, which will be retroactive to 3 days before the season starts. So it's not going to change the window. It's just a move that teams make as a corresponding move. And when the season starts and they need to make 40-man moves to either select the contracts of guys who are in camp as non-roster players, or if they want to claim somebody off waivers or sign a free agent or make a different kind of trade, whatever they want to do, when they need that roster spot, those guys will go onto the 60-day injured list. And in the short term, it doesn't really matter to the Astros whether they're on the 60-day IL, right now, or whether they go on the 60-day IL in April or May, because it doesn't change the outlook of when those guys are going to be back or when they're going to be eligible to be back. So it's just kind of like some baseball like transaction minutia. I get that it's frustrating for fantasy players in particular. If you got one of these guys and you just want to like plug them into that IL spot on your lineup and you can't do it, like that's irritating because you just want that roster spot to pick somebody else up. But baseball teams do not care about our lowly fantasy squads. So unfortunately, that's just part of the frustration that fantasy players deal with every year toward the end of spring training.
Right. I think it's also a rule that you can't move a guy to the 60-day injured list unless you're 40.
Unless it's a corresponding.
Unless your 40-man is full. And I guess I don't really know why that would be a rule other than the freak situation that you move someone to the injured list and then it turns out that they're actually not that injured and you did it for no reason. Maybe. I don't know.
Because you can't, like, I mean, I assume at that point you can't rescind it. Yeah. So it's just one of those, like, we'll do it when we need to.
Yeah. All right. Well, we got a question here from Wilson, who says basically he wants to know if the league is going to move more towards calling up younger guys. He points to the Angels and Rangers as guys who have been aggressively calling guys up, and wonders if this will get to teenagers being called up, listing Ethan Salas of the Padres, Max Clark of the Tigers, or Walker Jenkins of the Twins, if they're going to come up the way that Juan Soto, Mike Trout, and Bryce Harper did when they were coming up.
I think more than anything, you just look at Trout and Soto and Harper and kind of tip your cap to them as just like the freaks of nature that they are. Like, very few guys are even ready to be called up when they're teenagers, let alone like get called up as a 19-year-old and hit the ground running. It's not unprecedented. Obviously, we just listed those guys. And I think with somebody like Salas, who's so young and already so far up the minor league ladder, like, yeah, it's possible that he'll be up as a 19-year-old because he's just that advanced. But like, teams aren't saying, well, we can't call this guy up because he's 19, but he's ready. Like, if he was 19 years old and he's ready, like, there's a good chance he'd get called up. Oftentimes, I guess there's always the chance for service time games to be played, but more broadly speaking, it's just most 18 and 19 year olds would just get eaten alive by major league pitching. And so it's not a matter of like, oh, we don't want to be aggressive with these guys. It's just, it's foolish to be that aggressive with so many players, with the exception of like the very, very, very best talents in the world. And those guys just don't come along that often.
Yeah, case-by-case basis. Well, that's quite a show. Thank you so much for hanging out with me, Steve.
Yeah, thanks for for hosting and for you know, navigating through that that Jordan Montgomery deal as we talked. That was fun.
I've been waiting since I started doing this show. You know, I hope some big breaking news happens sometime when we're recording.
It was inevitable that it was going to happen.
Yeah. And it happened. So there we go. That was fun. Live reaction you can hear in this show. So that was exciting. And another thing that's exciting is baseball is back. We didn't even really talk enough about it, but baseball is back. By the time we have another show for you, we will have multiple games to overreact to and decide that this team is the best ever and this team is definitely dead after five games or whatever.
Never forget that, like, a month into the 2023 season, the Pirates were the best team in baseball. So, hey.
Yeah. And the 2019 Washington Nationals were terrible 2 months into the season. And then
in a couple weeks, we'll be talking about we'll be fielding, you know, questions about whether, you know, the 40 plate appearances somebody has had early in the season is, you know, sustainable or reason for panic, or whether it's, you know, that we'll get all the fun early season drama and small sample weirdness that comes. And I look forward to that stuff because it's always kind of fun to figure out and kind of place your. I shouldn't say place your bets, given the gambling tinge for this. But yeah, place your bets on what's real and what's not. So
we'll try to get DraftKings to sponsor our next episode, maybe. But
a nice full circle moment to close out the podcast.
All right. Well, that's enough for this week. You know, go to MLBTradeRumors.com because deals are still happening. Jordan Montgomery just signed while we were doing this episode. And if you sign up for the front office package, it gets rid of the ads and you get extra stuff. And it's awesome. And we will have another episode for you next week.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. Remember to visit MLBTradeRumors.com and follow us on Twitter at MLBTradeRumors.